From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Former Vice President Al Gore taught his first class at Columbia University Journalism School this week, but the most important lesson for his students may have been what transpired the following day. And that lesson is, don't provoke the press. Columbia's journalistic chieftains really should have known better. First they call a press conference, then they call it off. Then they say the lecture is off the record, then on the record, then off the record. Then they say it was their decision, then they say it was Gore's, and then they say it wasn't. At week's end, Columbia capitulated and took the gag order off once and for all. What made it all so much worse? It occurred at the nation's most prestigious journalism school, and most of the working press would never admit to setting foot in such a place, the general opinion being that J School is for pampered little wimps.
The media were not amused. The New York Times said the students learned three key points. One, if a newsworthy person says anything of interest in class, you can't write about it. Two, you can't talk about it either. And three, plenty of reporters are willing to pay you to break lessons one and two. The Boston Globe said it enabled students to learn firsthand the meanings of off the record, official waffling, and passing the buck. The Ventura County Star said, quote, the usual course for an electoral loser is not to hang out with a bunch of smart-mouthed ingrates. And the New York Post fumed, what a freaking disgrace.
Mr. Gore, why won't you allow the reporters inside?
It's the school's policy.
Would you invite us in if it was up to you?
I'm new here. That's above my pay grade. Thank you.
After the lecture, as the students filed out, they were overrun by reporters.
Can I talk to you?
Sure.
Or does somebody else want to do it? I heard you were on Fox. Does anyone want to do radio?
One of the students was Michael Arnone.
It's strange watching the coverage now after the day. It really has become a national story, which is quite ironic because when you think about it, the class is about national reporting, and he's there to impart his knowledge to us. But the fact that something that's completely out of his control became the national story related to this, it just goes to show that you can never expect where the real story is going to come from when you cover something.
Also, it tells you a little bit about how the press operates. Were you surprised by how the press operates?
No, not at all. I mean, I have some newspaper experience myself, but it is certainly different from the student perspective and also just as the source perspective to come in and suddenly have all these people swarming around you. I mean, I felt like I'd rubbed raw meat all over myself and jumped into a pool of piranhas.
Did anybody offer you money?
Yes, they did. I'm not going to say who or how much, but people were dying for exclusives, dying to get somebody to rat out what happened in the class in the off-the-record section.
So what happened in the class?
Well, Gore came in and, you know, he's very personable. You know, he's dressed very professorially. I mean, he had the cashmere jacket and the maroon sweater vest, and it was very much like one of his town hall meetings. Arms spread wide, you know, speaking in his big game show voice, you know, very stentorian. And even though I really can't share the content of what he taught us, he did it very well.
Now, you don't agree with this policy.
No, I don't.
But you're following it.
Yeah, well, I think it's out of a matter of respect. I understand why they're doing it. I don't think it's necessary. I mean, as a journalist, you have to respect on the record, off the record, or else you cannot work in the business. And it's something that's drilled into us.
What lessons have you learned from Al Gore lecturing you, either inside the classroom or outside?
It's gotten everybody at the school really thinking about the value of speaking on the record, off the record. What does it mean? I mean, is it bad that the university is trying to withhold information that is most likely harmless? Where is the university getting off in telling journalism students, of all students at the university, to restrict their speech? I mean, we don't know how the lesson's going to end up, and we certainly don't know what the test is going to be. But I think as a learning laboratory, this has been absolutely invaluable.
Michael Arnone, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bruce Cohen is an old-fashioned New York theatrical press agent, and I take it you were rather surprised at the way these journalism professionals handled the press.
Well, I was actually very surprised at many of the contradictions in the way they handled the press, as opposed to when they're pressed themselves, how they want to be handled. And in my business as a press agent, you either handle the press right or you'll find yourself not handling any press at all.
And so where did Columbia Journalism School go wrong?
They probably went wrong first by not hiring a press agent and a public relations professional.
Okay, after the plug, what then?
The greatest problem I had with the way they handled it was one of their spokesmen said that the lecture is not a news event. But the media was contacted for this. They were invited up for a photo opportunity and were quite taken aback by a journalism school telling their journalism students not to talk to the press. I think that's probably the headline error.
If they had come to you and said, okay, we've got Gore coming, he's giving a lecture, how do we deal with the press?
Gore would have had a press conference following the lecture, and then he could have commented on what the students asked him. And having just spent the last 16 years campaigning for president, he would know very well how to answer those questions. The journalists would have had their 800 words and their 90 seconds, and there wouldn't have been this embarrassing controversy. But when you have 25 reporters standing outside the door and you tell them no one's going to talk to you, you're going to have this kind of reaction. And Columbia University came off as bumbling. So I do think that the faculty and the administrative staff of Columbia University School of Journalism could use a couple of lessons in PR 101.
Thanks, Bruce. Bruce Cohen is a press agent based in New York City.
Al Gore's new job not only benefits students and the press in a slow news season, it also perpetuates an institution that had been fading from public discourse, the Al Gore joke. Herewith, on the media's secret tapes of office hours with Professor Gore.
You know, in my years as a reporter, I came up with a system for writing a news story you may find helpful, what I call the inverted pyramid technique. Under my plan, you start out with the most essential information, something I like to call the lead, then proceed to lay out the facts in descending order of importance. That way, the reader can easily read as much or as little as possible before getting on with their busy day. Readers like Dorothy Jimenez of Ypsilanti, Michigan, who spent several days thoroughly confused by a story that opened with featurey details. Who was the man sitting on the porch? Why is he eating salsa? Wait, this story is about NAFTA. It just didn't make sense. Now, to start addressing the specifics of your story, in the third graph you write that she turned on the light. Wouldn't it be more exciting if we moved that up and said, she invented electricity? Now on into your second graph, you write in some detail.
British agent James Bond faced death at the hands of many, a polite-talking madman. Maybe he could have avoided confrontation altogether if he'd flashed the bad guys a press card. A spy masquerading as a journalist makes a fine movie plot, but now the British Secret Service, also known as MI6, has been accused of adopting that very scenario. According to Richard Tomlinson, the renegade MI6 officer whose whistleblowing book The Big Breach, From Top Secret to Maximum Security, was just published in Russia, MI6 officers use journalistic cover on 4 of every 10 missions, in conflicts ranging from Afghanistan to the Balkans. Tim Gopless from the National Union of Journalists in Britain joins me. Mr. Gopless, if we're to believe what we hear from Richard Tomlinson, the British intelligence community and Fleet Street are dangerously intertwined. How much truth do you think there is to these charges?
Coming up, sex on TV skyrockets while taste on dating shows takes a dive.
Also, a video about the second coming makes it to the big screen, and your letters to On the Media.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, a couple of teenage girls I know were pretty excited about an upcoming episode of the WB high school drama Dawson's Creek. It seems that Joey and Pacey, a girl and boy engaged in some heavy breathing all season, were scheduled to have sex. 10 years ago, this would have been a big deal, but not anymore. According to a study released this week by the Kaiser Family Foundation, the number of programs with sexual content has soared from about half to more than two-thirds over the last 2 years, even higher in prime time. What apparently have not increased are messages about what the study calls safer sex, which have remained steady at about 10% of all programs with sexual content.
One television genre where you're sure to find all the sexual content you can handle is the dating show, although it wasn't always like that. When the dating game started in the 60s, there was a pretty girl choosing among three guys who might have been hoping for a goodnight kiss, and they exchanged a little bit of innocuous innuendo. A generation later, when Fox launched its program Studs, the innuendo was in your face. Looking ahead to Valentine's Day, we asked On the Media's Alicia Zuckerman to see how far Studs has taken us.
Ultimately, it was the early 90s Fox TV show Studs that led us to where we are today. Two men went on dates with three women. The men then had to guess which women said what about them, all for the honor of having little beanbag hearts slapped on their legs. The guy with the most beanbags won. The big question was always, did they or didn't they? Where before, even if the question crossed our minds, we thought, nah. Now we wondered, well, maybe. In the opinion of relationship expert Dr. Drew Pinsky, who became famous as the giver of sage advice on MTV's Loveline and on Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, even Studs didn't come close to what's on TV now.
Dating games were sort of cute to begin with, and they were fun. And now they've become exploitative and abusive.
Universal Television's Blind Date is one of today's most popular dating shows. Described as a multi-layered dating experience, the show follows a questionably matched couple on a 10-hour date and then edits it down to about 6 or 7 minutes. In addition to straying from the usual in-studio format that had come to define dating shows, the producers add their own thoughts, pop-up video style. But as co-creator Thomas Klein explains, the idea for the subtitles didn't come from the VH1 show.
Part of our inspiration came from the great Woody Allen movie, Annie Hall, that wonderful sequence between Woody Allen and Diane Keaton where they meet on, you know, on his balcony in his apartment in New York, and they're chit-chatting with each other, but he subtitles what they're really thinking and really feeling. This is what I think really happens all the time.
What would Blind Date have said about Woody Allen? The show can get pretty harsh. On a recent episode, when one woman repeatedly tells her date how much she distrusts men.
I don't know why I attract this guy. Do I have a sign right here on my forehead? Does it say, all lying, cheating,
the show stamped a graphic reading, damaged goods on her forehead. Producer Thomas Klein.
Sometimes the truth hurts. You know, there's a lot of truth in humor. And in what we do when we write these dates is we actually look at the relationship and the dynamic that's happening. And sometimes people are just mean to each other.
Dr. Drew is concerned about shows like Blind Date.
I am really disturbed by the kind of abusive, exploitative quality that these shows have taken on, and I think the producers need to search their souls a little bit.
He's also offended by shows like Change of Heart. That show sets supposedly committed couples up on dates with someone new to help them decide if they want to stay together or have a change of heart.
You had a usual complaint about Chris's hygiene. In fact, why don't you share that with everybody, please?
He doesn't wear underwear.
It's like Temptation Island. It's cruel. It's cruel. I'd rather watch gladiator fights.
Again, Dr. Drew.
Frankly, because at least then everyone knows what they're in the game for, and the pain ends swiftly. In this case, these are people that have, you know, interpersonal dynamic issues. They're sometimes quite serious, and they're being exploited.
It's hard to imagine why anyone would want to subject themselves to such potential humiliation on national TV. Blind Date producer Thomas Klein.
Most people are probably, that come on the show, are probably gamblers. You know, they go, what the heck? I'm in no worse situation than if I didn't go on the date anyway. Maybe, just maybe, I'll end up meeting somebody that I might connect to and have a relationship with.
In Dr. Drew's opinion, the reason is entirely different.
They actually believe it's going to create a television career. And it's that narcissistic society that we're in where celebrity is sort of the ultimate goal. And these people want to find any way to have a crack at it.
There does seem to be a disproportionate number of people who define themselves as actors and musicians on these shows. But when Michelle, who didn't want us to use her last name, went on MTV's Singled Out in 1996 as a 20-year-old Rutgers University student, she says it was just to have fun.
Michelle, say hello to the guys.
Hey, guys.
Say hi to Michelle.
Hey, Michelle!
The mid-90s dating show Singled Out was hosted by one-time Studs contestant Chris Hardwick, and first by Playboy playmate Jenny McCarthy, later by Carmen Electra. These shows want people who look good on TV. Michelle is tall and shapely, with wavy brown hair and great bone structure. The casting director told her she had what they were looking for.
I learned later that they had gone to a lot of clubs in New York to try to find attractive people and pick them out and ask them if they wanted to audition.
On these shows, image is everything. Singled Out wasn't about to let Michelle go on cold.
They have writers that help you. The questions are supplied, but some of the answers you make up on your own, and it was an interesting experience because they wanted to make sure that you didn't stutter or have nothing to say, so you had to let them know what your answers were going to be ahead of time.
In that sense, not much has changed since the 60s, when former homecoming queen Kathy Beben was plucked off of UCLA's sorority row to be on The Dating Game.
They told me that I wouldn't know anything about them and that I would be in a soundproof booth, but the booth was not soundproof, and so I could hear them introducing the guys.
Neither Kathy Beben nor Michelle ever ended up actually going out on a date with the guys they picked. Occasionally, though, a couple does click. Blind Date says 25% of their matches are successful, and Love Connection resulted in 35 marriages. Meanwhile, one dating show begets another. The people from Blind Date are producing 2 of 4 new dating shows for the fall lineup, each one pushing the boundaries of propriety a little further. Dr. Drew.
That reality component, that exploitative, voyeuristic element, garners ratings. And so they're just going for it. We've sort of not crossed that line until this point, and now here we are.
But maybe there is a line that the American public still won't cross. Who Wants to Date a Hooters Girl is limping along in a few markets, but has yet to make it with a national audience. For On the Media in New York, I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
Week in February is historically a downtime for movies. Pickings were so slim last weekend, you might have even considered taking in something called Left Behind, a sci-fi film based on a best-selling book and starring former sitcom kid Kirk Cameron. Probably, though, you didn't. But if you had, you would have become part of a movie experience unique in cinematic history, because you would have been sitting in a theater directly rented by the film's producers, watching a movie that had been available in video stores for months now. The people behind Left Behind will tell you that you're witnessing the future, and not just the future of movie marketing. On the Media's Mike Pesca reports.
Barbara Coulter has just popped in a video in her Lincoln Park, New Jersey home.
Pat Boone stars as the minister who actually led Nikki Cruz, who was a gang member, to the Lord.
The video is called The Cross and the Switchblade, a 1972 release, one of the rare instances when an evangelical Christian theme was tackled in a Hollywood movie. Barbara and I are each getting something different out of the video experience.
You actually watch Nikki become a Christian.
That's Eric Estrada.
Stupid sermon about honesty. I say we cross him up. We take all the bread and we give it to that stupid preacher.
Right now, Pat Boone has reached the members of the two rival gangs.
That's cool.
They're exchanging their switchblades for Bibles.
God loves you, he loves you, just as you are now standing there.
But this was almost, it was over 30 years ago. Left behind is the future.
Amen.
Coulter means that in every sense, except the figurative. She, and millions like her, believe that the Bible has prophesied that the day of judgment is nigh. The faithful will be called to heaven and non-believers will be left behind. It made for such good reading in one book series, the New Testament, that a theologian and a writer updated the prophecies and gave them a stronger narrative structure. So far, the Left Behind book series has sold 33 million copies. The movie is being rolled out in a unique way. The film's production company, Cloud 10 Pictures, has solicited sponsors to put up $3,000 each in order to bring the movie to a local Cineplex.
The movie was taken around and marketed to several of the huge theatrical release companies. The problem is, they don't typically market to the people that we market to, and they just didn't know how to reach them.
Byron Jones is the vice president of entertainment for Cloud 10 Pictures, Left Behind's production company. He says that when it comes to mainstream Hollywood fare, it's the Christian audience that has been left behind.
They market to the general audience. They do a very wide, massive print campaign and television and radio and spend literally millions of dollars to make the general public, anybody, it's sort of a shotgun approach. We don't have the money for that big a gun. So we do a very directed to our core buyers and get the word of mouth.
Barbara Coulter's chapel raised the $3,000 necessary to bring Left Behind to Parsippany, New Jersey.
How do you describe both a beginning and an end? We should have known better, but we didn't.
The sold-out screening is filled with people who know Barbara, or who know someone who knows Barbara, or knows about the screening because they visited Left Behind's website, or have already seen the movie on video. That's right, Left Behind was actually released on video first to prime the pump for this date. At the end of the video, star Kirk Cameron does some evangelizing of his own.
We need you to tell everyone you can about the February 2nd theatrical release. We need you to hang posters, we need you to pass out flyers, and to literally tell everyone you know about this movie. And if the movie is not sponsored in your community yet, we need you to try to make that happen too. And if we achieve this goal and then fill those theaters with people, we will be doing more than just sharing the most incredible story ever told with millions of people. We will also be sending a wake-up call to Hollywood.
No one heard the wake-up call in New York City. Unable to hook up with a church sponsor, Cloud 10 rented three Manhattan theaters on its own. Last Friday night's 7:15 showing at the Battery Park Multiplex brought in 15 customers. The 9:30 showing on opening night brought in 7. 33 million books sold and 22 total bodies on opening night?
The biggest problem of faith-based filmmakers is that they put the message ahead of the story. They're more interested in evangelism than entertainment.
Craig Detweiler stands at the intersection of movies and spirituality. A professional screenwriter by trade, he is the coordinator of film and media studies at the Fuller Seminary in Pasadena, California.
Left Behind clearly represents a narrow, old-school version of the end times. And for me, as a person who doesn't come out of that tradition, I watched the film and I was completely lost for the first 30 minutes. If the movie was intended to communicate to an audience who knows nothing of this theological framework, I think it fails.
Hollywood, on the other hand, knows how to quote scripture to suit its purpose.
Hollywood has loved religion traditionally, things like the Ten Commandments, greatest story ever told, you know, all the way back to the silent era of King of Kings, you know, 1927. Ben-Hur, certainly, early silent film remade in the 50s.
The 60s and 70s were a fallow period for religious movies, and they almost stopped altogether when Scorsese took on the crucifixion.
I think if you look at the way the faith community responded to a film like The Last Temptation of Christ, it was as if the church said, you know, hands off, he's our Messiah, you can't touch him.
Since then, films like The Prince of Egypt, miniseries based on the lives of both Jesus and Mary, and TV programs like Seventh Heaven and Touched by an Angel have proved that there is a market for religious fare. Specifically, religious fare with a palatable and ecumenical God. The repent or be damned message inherent in a movie like Left Behind is as outside the mainstream as ever. Inside.com's book editor, Sarah Nelson, sees the culture clash in play.
It scares a certain group of people that a book of this type that deals with religious issues like this is so popular. I think a lot of people in publishing are sort of snobby about what books are supposed to be, and that this book, which is not a high literary book, which is really a religious-themed book for the masses, is threatening to them.
As a book series, Left Behind has been unbelievably successful. As a video, it is surprisingly profitable. But as a movie, it's a much harder sell. It grossed just over $2 million its opening weekend, 17th on Variety's list, not enough to cover the cost of theater rentals. Despite front-page articles in last Friday's LA Times and Washington Post, Left Behind seems more a curiosity than a phenomenon. The only films likely to follow in its marketing plans will be others in the Left Behind series. Devotion and faith put this small evangelical movie in the theaters. It is the same uncompromising conviction that keeps it from filling the seats. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
This is the first time I'm going to the movie since high school, so.
Nah, you have to tell me. What was the last movie?
But take my take.
Oh, sure. I swear, I'll take the name off.
Okay, Godfather.
And so how does this compare to The Godfather?
A whole lot better.
This one was.
Yes, a whole lot better.
Okay, well that one won Academy Awards. Maybe this will do well.
Well, praise the Lord. Who knows?
Bob and I have been on the program now for 6 weeks. About time to read some of your letters.
All right. Michael Eisler said, our report on Bloody Sunday was a revelation, a dispassionate examination of the media by the media. Another listener, who didn't leave his name, called our rendition of Oedipus, as told in Vanity License Plates, a new low for radio.
Garfield's piece, or more accurately, screed on the British celebrity drought, prompted this from Mark Nymark. Alas, the election is finally over. Why not a cheap shot against Britain? What your story came down to was, British celebrities are only celebrities if they are known to Americans. Mr. Nymark signs off from Paris, France, a celebrity-free zone.
We'll get to France later. Of Mike Pesca's profile of Fox News personality Bill O'Reilly, Anita Hunt of Brooklyn wrote that it was wonderful that Mike Pesca points out that Bill O'Reilly is not an independent, as he claims, but has registered as a Republican for the past 5 elections. It's helpful to those who watch the news to know the political side from where the reporter comes. Accordingly, she says, she'd love to know the political affiliations of other news people, including Katie Couric, Peter Jennings, Bernard Shaw, or, for instance, Mike Pesca.
Well, actually, Mike is saving that revelation for his appearance on The O'Reilly Factor. After the piece aired, O'Reilly claimed he'd never heard of Mike Pesca, despite the fact that Mike interviewed him for over 2 hours. A back and forth ensued, and to make a long story short, Mike will appear on The Factor on Valentine's Day. And you can read about his preparations in his O'Reilly Diaries exclusively at onthemedia.org.
We had quite a few suggestions for our Word Watch segment. Those are the words or phrases that come into season to be used and abused by the media. Among them, schmooze, gender, notion, paradigm, and push the envelope. All right, stay tuned.
Meanwhile, keep pushing letters into your envelopes and send them to us at On the Media, WNYC, 1 Center Street, New York, New York, 10007. Or you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. Tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. Also, what you are hearing and seeing and reading and what you think about it all. We actually do want to know.
Coming up, real people made famous by movies and a movie great who remains anonymous.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. James Morrow is an editor and food critic at the internet magazine IronMinds.com. Recently, he wrote a column criticizing his favorite cable channel, the TV Food Network, about a cross-promotion with the Olive Garden restaurant chain. Morrow regards this relationship as a betrayal of viewer trust. Garfield came across the column and decided to offer Mr. Morrow his hospitality.
The word is hospitaliano. That's what the folks at the Olive Garden call it, the ready availability of authentic Italian cooking and atmosphere in any mall USA. But if I read James Morrow correctly, it's the authentic part he takes issue with, especially when he heard this on his favorite channel.
Now, Olive Garden, Food Network, and Calavita invite you to experience a once-in-a-lifetime 8-day trip to Italy in the Culinary Institute of Tuscany sweepstakes. Chef Romana Neri will personally teach you her secrets to cooking authentic Italian cuisine, the same way she teaches Olive Garden chefs at their culinary school in Tuscany.
Marketing makes strange bedfellows, but this particular copia made Morrow's marinara boil. So, to calm him down, I took him to dinner in the middle of Times Square at the Olive Garden. We were soon escorted to our intimate little corner, table 610, where it was soon clear that the man's irritation didn't begin with the trip to Italy promotion. He was already disgusted with the Food Network for shifting focus from food itself to big personalities, such as TV chef Emeril Lagasse.
Got this huge studio audience of mouth breathers who shrieks and whoops and cheers every time he goes, "Well, we're going to put about 25 cloves of garlic in here," or something like that. It's become as tasteless as a salad here.
Morrow ordered the chicken marsala. I chose my favorite, veal scallopini. We both passed on the special, chicken scampi, which of course means chicken shrimp, although the dish contains no shrimp. Such unhospitaliano corruption of Italian is no surprise when a company called Darden Industries, owner of the Red Lobster seafood chain, decides to get into ethnic cooking. But Morrow was unforgiving.
What we're talking about here is Italian culture and Italian food, one of the great cultures of the world, being turned around and pimped by a great big corporation. If you go to an Italian restaurant and ever hear in Italy and ever hear them use the word hospitaliano, I will eat my hat.
Not necessary. He had a gigantic plateful of chicken marsala right in front of him.
This is bland. There's something just weird. That there's some flavor I can't pin down. This is not really chicken marsala. I'm in a rage. I can't believe this.
Then he sampled my scallopini, which was, by any standard of cuisine or human decency, an atrocity. I haven't passed on a meal for 40 years, but this one, I must say, exceeded my giddiest expectations of inedibility. And ironically, this is what finally touched James Morrow's tender soul.
I'm just sad now, just thinking about it. I've gone from angry to just sad. This is like the five stages of grief here. They're saying, we're going to sanitize this whole experience for you, have lots of vowels at the end of all the nouns, and you can go home and say, oh gosh, wasn't that just a lovely Italian meal?
Despite repeated badgering, neither the Food Network nor the Olive Garden cared to defend themselves against charges of Epicurean prostitution. And I reluctantly concede, in a media world that is a vast Italian buffet of unsavory synergies, this issue is like one skinny breadstick. But as the Italians always say, che sera, sera. The waiter came by and, with gracious hospitality, offered to wrap our $59 leftovers to take home. We graciously declined.
Last week saw the passing of Fast Eddie Parker. He was a pool player and a hustler. In fact, he was the hustler, the inspiration for the 1961 Paul Newman movie. The movie's main character went by Fast Eddie Felsen. Parker also used Felsen as an alias. Hustlers do that.
In recent years, Parker tried to separate himself from the movie. Being known as the hustler dramatically decreases your chances of taking an unsuspecting mark by surprise. While Parker was a singular character, he had plenty of company in the club of people who see themselves become movies.
A year ago, there was a woman living in California named Erin Brockovich. That same woman is now named the real-life Erin Brockovich. The real-life Jerry Stahl was a television writer whose drug habit resulted in firing, near death, and ultimately a memoir. And the memoir went on to become a movie starring Ben Stiller. I asked the real-life Jerry Stahl to talk about having his life turned into a movie.
Well, you know, it's a strange thing. I remember the first day of shooting, I went down to the studio, and I tried to get past the guy at the door. You know, they have this sort of guys in tool belts with like a donut in one hand and a hammer in the other, and he didn't know who I was, so he wouldn't let me in. I finally said, well, you know, man, I'm the guy they made the movie about. He said, oh, dude, that's so great, man. They don't usually make movies about losers. It's flattering to be up there in an esteemed group that includes, you know, Larry Flint and Serpico, like living human beings who've had the semi-sweet thrill of seeing themselves portrayed on screen.
Ah.
You know, it's very surreal because the woman who played my girlfriend was an actress who actually looked like the woman who I wasn't seeing anymore. So I was in the odd position of looking at the movie and being jealous of myself for being able to be with this actress. So it's, you know, it's a very surreal existential predicament one finds oneself in.
But you say it was a sweet thrill, or rather a semi-sweet thrill.
I mean, you know, look, it's a, considering, you know, that I was basically living in a car or, you know, working at McDonald's a few years before, I didn't know at the time I was doing research, put it that way.
Did you look at yourself differently? Did you see yourself up there? Did you see Ben Stiller?
I saw a much cuter version of myself, that's for sure. On the other hand, there was a few days when it looked like it was going to be John Bon Jovi, so I can't complain.
So what about the way people saw you? If you wanted to pretend to be somebody else, if you wanted to be different past, you had nowhere to hide.
Well, that's a good point. I think, you know, if you lived a life like mine, you got two choices. You can sort of look over your shoulder and hope nobody finds out that you spend a lot of time with guys named, you know, Pepe and Dog, you know, slinging crack in MacArthur Park, or you can figure, well, you know, this is who I am, this is what I did, and anybody left talking to me is my friend, and anybody else, you know.
Do you think people made friends with you because of the movie?
I wouldn't say they made friends with me, but, you know, total strangers felt comfortable enough to come up and tell me the most heinous secrets of their entire lives because they felt like they knew mine.
Would you recommend the cinematic treatment to others?
Well, there's no therapy like having people make a movie of your own life, that's for sure. One thing I realized in some strange way, even though, you know, much was changed. For example, in the movie, because the actress playing my mother, for whatever reason, didn't work out, they basically killed my mother. So
oh my God.
I had to explain to the poor woman, like, you know, like I hadn't put her through enough. I had to say, geez, Mom, you know, you've been killed off in this movie, so, you know, tell everybody in the beauty parlor. You know, if we could all have independent movies made of our lowest moments, we'd probably we would all treat each other better, I think, that's for sure. Because I realized, just what a selfish freak I was when I, you know, saw the look on other people's faces by the things Ben Stiller playing me did. And somehow you can know that in the abstract, and you can talk to people and try to make amends. But in some strange way, seeing it on screen, it was like I got to step outside and say, Jesus Christ, you really were a jerk.
Jerry Stahl, thank you very much for talking to us.
You're the best. Thanks so much.
Jerry Stahl's memoir, Permanent Midnight, was made into a film starring Ben Stiller, and his novel, Perv, is now out in paperback. Real people, as we heard, can be changed by their cinematic portrayals. But there is one performer whose work has appeared in film after film, yet remains utterly anonymous.
Most actors would die for a resume like Wilhelm's. Although Wilhelm has appeared in some of the most popular movies ever, he isn't an actor, though he was probably created by one. Wilhelm is a sound effect. More specifically, Wilhelm is a scream. On the Media's David Sirchuk reports.
The Wilhelm has punctuated the death and dismemberment of dozens of characters in some 20 to 25 movies, particularly in those associated with George Lucas. With appearances in some of history's biggest hits, from Star Wars to Raiders of the Lost Ark to Toy Story, clearly this sound gets around. In addition to the aforementioned blockbusters, the scream appeared in lesser Lucas films, like Howard the Duck and Willow, as well as the Star Wars parody Spaceballs. Prior to being adopted by the Lucas team in 1977, the Wilhelm got its shot in Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch in 1967, and co-starred with Judy Garland in 1954's A Star Is Born. It even appeared in John Wayne's gritty drama The Green Berets in 1968.
That's what it's all about, Mr. Beckwith!
After The Green Berets, the Wilhelm went on sabbatical until it was revived in Star Wars. It appears in the scene where Luke and Leia bravely blasted stormtroopers from across a bottomless pit in the Death Star. Right before our heroes swing across, young Skywalker shoots a stormtrooper who falls both into the depths and Hollywood history. The Wilhelm is also in Steven Spielberg's Raiders of the Lost Ark. In this film, the Wilhelm again marks the falling death of a bad guy. The Wilhelm comes into play this time while Indiana Jones fights off Nazis, while simultaneously driving a truck. All the commotion causes one poorly balanced Nazi to fall out. But the Wilhelm has graced smaller films as well. Prior to its use in these hits, it gave years of service to such B-movie classics as 1954's Them, where it punctuated James Whitmore's death in the mandibles of a giant ant. But the Wilhelm's work in Them was not finished, for it also became the death knell of an army private later in the film. The Wilhelm was popularized in name by Ben Burtt, the Oscar-winning sound editor for Star Wars, says Richard Anderson, sound editor and president of Weddington Productions in North Hollywood. Anderson worked with Burtt on both Star Wars and Raiders, placing the Wilhelm in the latter film. He said Burtt, an old-time Hollywood film buff, was inspired to track the sound to its roots, after noting how frequently it occurred in his favorite B-films.
The earliest film that he had noticed that it was in was a film called Charge at Feather River, which was made in 1953, I believe. There's a character in the movie named Wilhelm, and at one point in the movie, he's there riding along, and then the arrow flies in and hits him in the leg, at which point he does this now-famous scream.
Wilhelm!
Yeah, I'll just fill my pipe!
Anderson adds that Burtt was eventually able to track the first use of the Wilhelm to an even earlier film.
While at Warner Brothers, he ultimately found the original source recording of it under the title Man Being Eaten by Alligator. It turns out that this film was a 1951 film called Distant Drums, directed by Raoul Walsh and starred Gary Cooper.
The Wilhelm also surfaced in the 1955 film In the Land of the Pharaohs, where it is again used by a character battling a large reptile, in this case, a crocodile, except this time it comes from inside the crocodile after the character is eaten. Rick Henson, president of the Motion Picture Sound Editors, showed a short compilation of films with the Wilhelm at the MPSE Golden Reel Awards last spring. Henson says part of the attraction of the Wilhelm is that it helps sound editors personalize their projects, even if no one notices it but them or other sound editors.
I think it's very much a sense of marking your film, of autographing the sound on it.
Steve Altobello, sound editor at Spin Cycle Post in New York, has used the Wilhelm in three films, including the Jay-Z documentary Backstage. He says part of the pleasure in using the Wilhelm is that it doesn't fit naturally into the small, independent films he mostly works on.
I don't want to say it's a stupid sound, but it's ridiculous. It's certainly extremist. You watch it once and you don't know it's there. You're like, okay, this scene's fine. But when you watch it knowing it's there, it really does leap out of the soundtrack too. You're like, oh my God, that's a huge, ridiculous scream there, but it works. They always find the right spot, the right frame.
Sound editors like Anderson and Altobello say that often when directors notice the Wilhelm, they demand it be pulled. But it seems it's become almost an obsession for Altobello. And frequently, the first thing he looks for in a new project is the Wilhelm moment.
I've even tried to mix it in, like mix it into a track so that it can't be removed. Like, if you want this car sound on that TV set, you gotta have the scream. I can't even turn, you know, and I act stupid, like, well, I don't know. That's just part of it, you know? I tried to get it into an HBO after-school special about not using drugs, but the filmmaker pulled it out. I tried to get it into a film called Chicago Cab, and they were like, you've got to be kidding me.
Altobello and Henson both admire how the Wilhelm infiltrated A Star Is Born. In fact, they each cited it as their favorite use of the sound. Altobello even went so far as to say he uses it as an homage to that movie rather than the Lucas films.
Whoever put it in the movie in the background for one scene, that's fine. That was probably expected. But whoever found a way to weasel it into the arrangement of a Judy Garland song, that's somebody who really pulled off the ultimate, I think, because the movie stops and it's the only thing that's happening. I'll never be able to pull that off.
Somewhere there's a someone,
Rick Henson of the MPSE added that another creative application of the Wilhelm is in the 1995 Disney film A Goofy Movie. This use is especially interesting, he said, because Goofy himself has his own signature yodel that in the fashion of the Wilhelm has been used in many other Disney films. The Wilhelm appears this time as Goofy carelessly drives into the ladder of some characters working on a roadside.
The map will guide us straight and true. Roxanne, please don't forget me. I will return someday. Oh, I may be in traction when I do.
In addition to being Goofy, however, Altobello finds the continued use of the Wilhelm somewhat disturbing. He says it's intriguing and spooky that this sound continues to be used years after the original unknown actor has probably passed on.
It was one guy who really did this for whatever reason. It could have even been a sound editor. It could have been vocal talent that was hired. Did it 50 years ago, and it's still floating around. It's a really creepy concept. I always wondered about people who were relatives of, like, the woman whose voice is on At the Tone, The Time Will Be. I always thought, well, what if that's some guy's, like, ex-girlfriend or something, and he just calls and listens to The Time?
Whatever the fate of the original actor who voiced the Wilhelm, this scream of death has plenty of life left. In addition to its recent use in the trailer for Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, shooting is currently underway for Episode II. And if Episode II doesn't do so well, maybe George Lucas would consider a remake of Charge at Feather River. If he does, it's a safe bet they'll know which sound to start with. For On the Media, I'm David Surchak.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by George Edwards with Steve Sciarto, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Dylan Keefe, Kira Devenbrock, and David Surchak.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. bassist-composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Funding for On the Media is made possible by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bydale Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.